FoxSports.com senior columnist who has written a great book, and we're going to talk about the book. Bruce Feldman, welcome back to Tuscaloosa. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, Ryan. Always good to talk to you.
Absolutely, and I know you've been, I'm sure, a lot of different places right now. We're going to work in our college football playoff because we want to get your opinion on that as well. But the big thing is the book is now out. And give us a little bit of a preview. The quarterback, the making of modern quarterbacks is now on the book stands and available online, the Kindle version and the different versions online as well.
Well, Ryan, you know, it's obviously the most important position in all of sports. And it's really grown in how it is taught and coached and even how it's evaluated. And I think you look and see so many examples of guys that they get ready for the draft and they turn out to be busts or whatever. And what I wanted to focus in on is how much of the process, what's it like, really like to be in the middle of it all. And so the book is really told through the eyes of three main characters: Trent Dilfer, who's the former Super Bowl winning quarterback, who by his own admission had a really up and down NFL career. He did go to Pro Bowl, but he says he's quite candid. You know, I'm haunted by the failures of my own career. And he's up at night in the middle of the night a lot studying film because he says he felt like he was taught a lot of things that were fundamentally wrong, even at the highest level. And he said he didn't want the other younger quarterbacks and other quarterbacks to make the same mistakes he had made. And then the other two primary characters are George Whitfield, who's a protege of Dilfer, who works with so many college quarterbacks. He was Johnny Manziel's, mentor, so to speak, and he has, worked with Cam Newton, works with Everett Golson, Connor Cook from Michigan State, Bryce Petty from Baylor, and a bunch of other guys. And then it was Johnny Manziel himself. So I was behind the scenes at Texas A&M last year and also around Manziel throughout from the end of his season all the way up till his pro day when he got ready for the draft. So you kind of walks the reader all the way through, but there's other layers of the book. Unlike my other books were strictly all college football, this one has some other stuff. I mean, there's a chapter on the Manning camp. There's a chapter on Tom House, who is Drew Brees and Tom Brady's gurus, old Nolan Ryan and Randy Johnson pitching coach. But then there's also layers of this year's high school recruiting class and how they're related to it. And one of them for Alabama fans to be interested in is Blake Barnett. I spent some time with him, so you get to see Blake Barnett's development as a quarterback. You know, his one of the guys who he is really coached by, Dennis Guile, is a Trent Dilfer protege. And so you kind of see how Blake Barnett's career starts to take off and how he handles the recruiting process. And So I think there's something for a lot of people in this book to really grasp onto.
Let me go back to the quarterback for just a couple of minutes. What separates the good quarterbacks from the great quarterbacks?
I think the biggest thing is the ability to solve problems and take bad situations and thrive in them. I think that's more than anything else. I mean, you can have guys with really strong arms. You can have guys who are really athletic. You can have guys with prototype size and everything else. You know, if you can't have like a plan B and improvise and react and take advantage of situations, I think, and certain guys are wired for that better than others. I mean, the example I would use for this year is Jeff Driscoll is a quarterback who had all kinds of hype coming out of high school. He's big, he's strong, he's fast, his arm is good, he's tough. You know, even coaches who work with him say he's accurate. But when a couple of bad things happen, it seems like confidence starts to wane and they just kind of start to go downhill. And I think there are some quarterbacks who are like that, who on paper or at drills look great, but then once it gets into the heat of the game, some things start to go south and it starts to fall apart. And I think there are certain quarterbacks who just really respond at their best to pressure, whether it's in a big game or it's in a 2-minute drill or when they're moving and up tempo, it just all clicks for them. And I think those are challenging things for evaluators to get a great sense of.
We're talking to Bruce Feldman right now. We're talking about the new book that's on the book stands right now, The Quarterback, The Making of Modern Quarterbacks. And I don't want to give away all the secrets to the book. I want folks to go out and support it and buy it. Bruce Feldman written several different books in the past, and we've spoken about those. But going back for just a couple of minutes, is the quarterback the equalizer? Can it create more parity in college football, because you see teams that maybe don't have all the skill positions that can be competitive, but that one quarterback that comes along and you get that quarterback, he can equalize the recruiting and even, you know, a money situation on smaller schools.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not a smaller school, but Johnny Manziel is a big part of this book, and one of the reasons why is Texas A&M, you know, had rich football tradition, but it had been kind of underwhelming for a long time. And then Kevin Sumlin gets there, and Johnny Manziel becomes his quarterback, and, you know, they shocked Alabama, you know, 2 years ago, and that leads them to win a Heisman Trophy. And it wasn't like, you know, they didn't win an SEC championship, but he made Texas A&M relevant. And it wasn't like Texas A&M had a great defense. I mean, last year they had a terrible defense. But, you know, a lot of money came into the school, a lot of influence. They recruited really well. They built off it. And, you know, I think a lot of that had to do with not just his talents, but the way they showcased his talents, the way they kind of managed him. And I think you see, you know, in the QB, the reader will get a really good sense of just how chaotic and crazy things got around Johnny Manziel and how they were able to kind of surf their way through it. But, you know, the detail that I was able to have for that part of the book, I think will really open a lot of people's eyes, and they'll be like, wow, I never knew it was this crazy.
Oh, just the prep time. And I've spoken to different guys that have played at this level, and it's amazing. Sometimes, you know, when we get to the pay for play and how many hours really go into a quarterback, but if you're a starting quarterback in the major five conferences, I'd hate to see a stopwatch on exactly how much prep time you spend in preparing for the upcoming games, because I don't see how these guys take difficult majors because of the time that it requires to prep to be the quarterback.
Yeah, I mean, as simple as this, and Dilfer says this in the beginning of the book, we're out at Ohio State, and they're basically, you know, taking over the campus. You know, Urban Meyer's giving them the run of the place, and he says how the guy behind who takes the center snap, how he performs on Saturday affects everybody almost in that community in one way or another. It affects, you know, it affects his coach, it affects the AD, it affects the other students, it affects, you know, like it can
local
bring
economy,
in
local economy,
yeah,
talk
can bring
radio
in
shows,
business, everything. People's moods are taken. You know, applications can go up in terms of, you know, I don't want to say it's always like that, but it can have that kind of impact on whether you win or lose. And ultimately, let's be honest, coaches do not get fired whether they graduate or don't graduate their players. They get fired if they win games or not.
Bruce Feldman, let's move to another conversation. We'll touch on it as we close out the segment. But College Football Selection Committee poll was released. Your thoughts about those final the top four in the initial rankings?
I think it was interesting that for a couple of examples of, because we didn't know exactly what they were going to value. And I really thought, and I think a lot of people assume, that they would value best, quote-unquote, over maybe most deserving, which would be resume. And I would use the example of Alabama. I thought they would have been higher up. You know, if you were to ask me who are the three best teams in college football, I would have Alabama as one of them. But they were sixth, and I think it's a function of Alabama's best win on the resume is over two-loss West Virginia. After that, it's probably the dominating performance against a Texas A&M program that's been, like, plummeting in the rankings. So I think that's what they measured. On the flip side of it, I think to see Notre Dame down at 10, I don't know, you know, a lot of other schools, if I'm an Alabama fan, I'm not too worried about the rankings because you control your own destiny. You know, if your team wins and beats some of these other teams that are going to play head-to-head, they're going to spring up the rankings. Notre Dame only has really two recognizable, I think, entities in front of them. Now, if Louisville beats Florida State, that would give them a third. I don't think that's going to happen, but we'll see. But, you know, as far as Arizona State, they play on the road, and then they play later in the year at USC. But when it comes to USC, if Notre Dame beats USC, they're going to be 8-4. I'm not sure USC is even ranked then. So I think that kind of undermines some of the credibility that Notre Dame can get. So if I was a Notre Dame fan after the rankings last night, I'd be very, very troubled.
When you look at Alabama, what do you see?
I see a pleasantly surprising performance from Blake Sims. I like what they're doing with him. I think he has been much better than a lot of us thought. Now, we knew that they were going to have big-time running backs, and we knew Amari Cooper was going to be a stud. But I think Blake Sims has been a nice surprise in how he's – not that he's given them something in the run game, but just I think he's – he's been multidimensional, and he's handled situations pretty well. You know, the defense, my one question with them is still the same one, is if they get up against a mobile quarterback, can they contain him well enough? You know, I mean, even some of the stuff with Tennessee last week, Josh Dobbs, who I had expected to redshirt, he came in and did some positive things there against a, you know, a really talented defense. You know, but I know Alabama's been banged up a little bit, and I think that is noteworthy. But, you know, Blake Sims has been one of the better, more pleasant surprises, I think, in college football this season.
Crazy hypothetical question, but if Alabama runs the table, looking at what was returning, is Nick Saban in that National Coach of the Year type conversation?
He's in the conversation, I think, you know, fair or unfair, because people look at how many five-star guys he has, and when you got T.J. Yeldon and Henry and Amari Cooper and, you know, a lot of guys on defense, I think people, you know, just assume you're going to win, you know, you're going to go 11-1 or 12-1. You know, I would look at, you know, a guy like Brian Kelly, who has an academic scandal unfold on his, you know, on his campus right before the start of the season, where he loses his best defensive player and, you know, a couple other starters. And if they go, and I don't think anybody had big expectations on them. And so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I would put a guy like Dan Mullen, if they can sustain it in there, where the expectations are lower. You know, if you're Jimbo Fisher, if you're Nick Saban, we expect, you know, you to be top five every year at this point. And I think, you know, if I'm Nick Saban, I'm okay with that, because I don't know if I need Coach of the Year trophies to validate what I'm doing there. I mean, I think he's got rings that carry a lot more weight than those Coach of the Year trophies, which usually come up for, like, a good year from somebody who usually doesn't have a good year.
And I know that's probably just local bias, but you just see so many different areas that you didn't know if you had an answer, and somehow they found answers. And you could talk about Blake Sims, you could talk about different positions. Moving to another position, you have a Heisman vote. Amari Cooper right now, 71 receptions, 1,132 yards. We know the type of season that he's having. If he can continue that, do you think he's going to go to New York City? I don't think he's going to win it, but do you think he deserves to be in this conversation?
I think in the conversation, yeah. I think we need to see who else is out there. I think typically wide receivers who aren't return guys, you know, really don't have much chances. You know, whether it's a Michael Crabtree or somebody like that, you know, even if you put up ridiculous numbers, obviously Crabtree did, but you know, it depends on what's out there. I could give you a quick scenario. If Marcus Mariota and Oregon lose to Stanford, no matter what Marcus Mariota's stats are, I think a lot of people would have a hard time voting for him, just like, you know, Peyton Manning not beating Florida when he was at Tennessee. So, you know, and if Dak Prescott stumbles, we're going to have to find candidates from someplace else. I know one of the guys that people, you know, are going to have to think about, at least, and that's Jameis Winston. I mean, it's 15 of 16 in the second half against Notre Dame. His team's top five. They don't have, you know, they haven't been great in some other areas. But having said all that, a lot of Heisman voters will not have the stomach to vote for Jameis Winston because of all the off-field issues. And plus, you know, he got himself suspended for the Clemson game. That didn't help his cause either. So once you start pulling those names out, I mean, I would have a hard time. I couldn't see myself voting number one of these Big Ten running backs number one. I mean, I think I could have Tevin Coleman from Indiana somewhere on my ballot because he's a one-man show. I think Melvin Gordon, same deal at Wisconsin. But, you know, there's just not like that long list. Maybe Trevon Boykin keeps it up at TCU. I don't know. It's, you know, after Mariota and Prescott, I feel like there's quite a bit step down now of who else is going to emerge.